KALW.
People saying, oh, like, this is stupid. Why is this being an Olympic sport? Blah, blah, blah. Like, should staring contests be next in the Olympics?
Breakdancing is making its Olympic debut this weekend, and there are some mixed feelings about it.
There was an ongoing debate, like, is it an art? Can it be a sport?
Today, we break it down. Then a singer-songwriter from South Texas looks back at his early days in the Bay.
The first time I ever got up on blues clubs and stuff was like the saloon there in North Beach, you know, getting up with the rockabilly and the older generation, all the black blues players.
And a new podcast asks, what actually is wilderness?
Now you're like, oh, this is beautiful. And you go around the corner, it's like, oh, this is beautiful. And it just keeps going.
How Wild, from our very own Marissa Ortega Welch. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. We start today's show at the Olympics. Many of us are watching our favorite athletes compete in Paris. And though it's a spectacle we often think of as steeped in tradition, new sports are constantly being added to the games, like surfing and skateboarding at the 2020 Games in Tokyo. This summer's new event is breaking, often known as breakdancing, though breakers themselves don't really use that term. It's an addition that has its critics. There are purists who don't think breaking is rigorous enough to be an Olympic sport, while other people worry that sportification takes breaking too far from its roots. Reporter Cheryl Kaskowitz takes us to San Francisco's Mission District to find out what local breakers think before the event hits the Olympic stage tomorrow.
If you have any doubts that breaking is athletic enough to belong in the Olympics, I suggest taking a visit to the Mission Cultural Center on a Wednesday night. As you walk up to the third floor, the music is already spilling from the room at the top of the stairs. Studio B. There are about 12 dancers spread out in a loose circle. They're watching a guy dressed all in black in the middle. He kicks into a spinning headstand, his legs moving as if he's dancing upside down. Then he jumps back on his feet and joins the outer circle. Then the next breaker takes the floor. There seems to be an unofficial uniform, sneakers, baggy pants, and a hoodie or a beanie that allows for literal head spinning. It's hot up here, and most of the dancers are drenched in sweat. This is the center's weekly breaking session. It's called a cipher.
The cipher is like a place for everyone to kind of get down and exchange with each other. It's really supposed to be like the purest form of breaking.
Rahul Doraswamy hosts these weekly sessions. He started them around 2017 when he realized that there wasn't really a gathering place for breakers in the Mission anymore. A space with deep community roots had closed down during the tech boom in 2012. Rahul had discovered breaking about 5 years earlier when he was a student at UC Berkeley.
And it was like the most like amazing thing I had ever seen. Like the entire hallway was like full of like different cyphers, like different people. And like these like world famous B-boys from the Bay Area would come here. And I was like so starstruck.
There were breakers from well-known crews like Renegade Rockers from San Francisco.
Renegade Rockers!
And members of Style Elements crew from Stockton, Modesto, and San Jose. There's also a rich history of breaking in places like Oakland, Vallejo, and Richmond.
Really, there's scenes just like all over the Bay Area, and each one is like very unique.
These Bay Area crews have thrived as a kind of underground scene for a long time, away from the mainstream. But breaking is about to appear on one of the biggest world stages there is. This weekend, it will make its debut as an Olympic sport. And of course, the breakers at the Wednesday night cipher have heard all about it, good and bad.
They just don't think that it should be considered an Olympic sport.
Jeremy Varey comes up to these weekly sessions from San Jose.
People saying, oh, like, this is stupid. Why is this being an Olympic sport? Blah, blah, blah. Like, oh, should staring contests be next in the Olympics?
He says he wishes people would do some research to find out what's involved in breaking and understand its history.
I think there should be a little bit more appreciation towards what we do, and what breakers do, and where it came from, how African Americans and Latinos created this dance.
Breaking is a fundamental part of hip hop culture. As the story goes, it all started in August 1973. An 18-year-old known as DJ Kool Herc was DJing at a street party in the Bronx. Rahul explains.
The origin of the term breakdancing actually comes from this idea of a break in a record. And there'd be a part in the record, I'm sure you've heard a lot of soul songs, where like there's kind of like a drum solo almost, and it's like you hear like a boom, boom, cap, boom, boom, you know?
Here's a classic known as the Amen Break from a song by the Winstons.
And what they would do is he would take that part of the record and he would just loop it over and over again. So you get this continuous like boom, boom, cap, boom, 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 cap over and over again. And when he would loop the record, a lot of times people at the party would start dancing, they would start breaking. So they would dance to the break of the record, which is why it was called breaking.
But it's not like breaking went directly from a 70s street party to the Olympic Games. Breaking crews started staging competitions in clubs, and it got more and more popular. In 1983, breaking entered the pop culture mainstream when it appeared in the movie Flashdance. This is around when outsiders started calling it breakdancing, a term that most breakers dislike. The first international competition was in 1990, and since then, breaking moves started becoming more standardized.
You have, like, top rock. You're dancing up top. You're not necessarily touching the floor yet.
And then there are drops.
Which is, you know, your transition from, like, the top to the bottom. There's footwork. There's power moves, which is a lot of the, like, windmills, flares, kind of the more, like, dynamic kinds of movements.
When you want to hold any type of pose, that's called a freeze.
A lot of times you'll have, like, your elbow, like a handstand or something.
This weekend, there will be 32 breakers, 16 B-boys and 16 B-girls from all around the world, from Korea to Kazakhstan. They'll compete against each other in battles. It's a very different format from a cypher where people are getting encouragement from the circle.
In the earliest days, like, the reason battles happen is because a lot of times these different crews or these different people had, like, real, like, beef with each other. Like, breaking was, like, a way for them to do that without them having to actually fight because they were at a party.
In a battle, breakers need to be able to react to whatever their opponent does, so there's no preset choreography to be judged against. They also don't get to pick their music. The DJ decides what to play, and breakers need to choose their moves on the fly. At the Olympics, there'll be 9 judges, and they choose a winner based on 5 criteria. Vocabulary, which is the variety of moves, originality, technique, execution, and musicality.
And then musicality, obviously, like, are you, like, listening to the music? This whole dance has to be on beat.
So deciding winners and losers in breaking is maybe less straightforward than a lot of Olympic sports. And this makes sense, since breaking is, at its core, a dance. But this balance between creativity and athleticism can make things complicated.
There was an ongoing debate, like, is it an art? Can it be a sport?
That's Amy Shia. At the Mission Cultural Center Cypher, she's been practicing head spins, her dark hair coming loose from its low ponytail.
Is it something that can even be judged in that way? Can you judge art in an athletic way?
Other breakers at the Cypher had similarly mixed feelings. Here's Jeremy again.
It stems from hip-hop. Hip-hop is, you know, is art, is its culture. I think it would be a disservice to call breaking just a sport. Don't forget where it came from. Don't forget that it's art, you know?
And Jeremy says that when you're watching, no matter what the judges say, look at what impression it leaves on you.
Look at how much fun people have when they dance. Look at how expressive they are. Just try to feel something when you watch it, because that's what a lot of people, when they dance, they want people to feel what they're feeling. They want people to connect with them and want people to connect to the music as those dancers are connecting to that music as well.
I would also say, just, you know, like, don't stop there. Like, you'll see in the Olympics, but come to events in your city.
Rahul says the best way to learn more about breaking is to see it in action, a cypher like this one or a one-time event.
If you're traveling somewhere, just kind of keep an eye out for breakers and understand that there's, like, a rich cultural history behind this thing that's on the stage, and it's not just a moment.
This summer might be the first and last time that breaking will be an Olympic sport. since it won't be included in the 2028 Games in Los Angeles. But the vibrant breaking culture in cities across the Bay Area isn't going anywhere. In San Francisco, I'm Cheryl Kaskowitz for Cross Currents.
There will be 2 days of breaking battles at the Olympics starting tomorrow, August 9th. And on September 14th, you can catch local breakers here in San Francisco at an event hosted by Rahul and Jeremy's crew, Elephant Graveyard. Find more about that and a link to other Bay Area breaking sessions at klw.org/crosscurrents. Yes, my name. I'm on the microphone and my brain just came. I want to see and feel your body. So jump around and move everybody. 1, 2, hit the floor. 3, 4, 5, scream on once more. So come on around and give you a slow check. Thanks to the rhythm of freestyle project. Bass, in my face. Turn up the rhythm. Got to hit the rhythm. Pumping, jumping. Got the people like moving, grooving. How you wanna move? Take the groove. There we kick it like smooth. Turn it up, baby. Show me your respect. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Outside Lands, the 3-day music festival in Golden Gate Park, is back this weekend for its 16th year. And as usual, there's no shortage of stellar artists slated to perform, from Post Malone to Grace Jones to Killer Mike. And one out-of-town musician brings a special reverence for the Bay Area. Reporter Raphael Cohen introduces us to Charlie Crockett, a troubadour from South Texas whose time in the Bay catapulted a chart-topping career.
Playing an eclectic blend of country, blues, folk, and soul, something he dubs Gulf and Western, and the music industry more reductively labels Americana, singer and songwriter Charlie Crockett has always defied easy categorization. Born in the economically depressed border town of San Benito, Texas, Charlie went on to busk in Dallas, New Orleans, and New York City.
I'm going around this world, going around it pretty good.
He mostly played covers on an old acoustic guitar his mother had purchased at a pawn shop when he was just a kid. But nowadays, 40-year-old Charlie Crockett's putting out multiple albums a year, and accompanied by his exceptional band, the Blue Drifters, selling out large-scale music venues from coast to coast. I sat down with Charlie to hear how the Bay Area's played an especially pivotal role in the development of his style and sound. Backstage before a show in Brooklyn, swiftly signing posters with a silver ink Sharpie, Charlie details the circuitous events that sent him out west.
I was a young, desperate man. I was exactly who they were looking for. And in my desperation, you know, I think I was maybe a bit blind. I got to take some responsibility for that.
Charlie's referring to the record deal he scored as part of a ragtag collective of musicians and rappers called the Train Robbers, after they'd caught the attention of some Sony music execs while playing the New York subway. It proved to be fool's gold, forcing him to suppress his unique genre-bridging approach.
I remember when that deal fell apart, I was so depressed that I just couldn't go back to playing on the street in this town. And we ended up hopping a freight train out of Allentown, Pennsylvania. Eventually ended up in the Bay Area, actually.
Charlie's arrival to town, circa 2012, wasn't by happenstance. In fact, the Bay had long held a mythical standing in his imagination, and a more tangible one in his family's lineage.
My mama was born in Denver, but she was raised in the Bay. You know, she grew up around Concord, Vallejo, Benicia. And on her side of the family, they're all still out there, you know. And the way that she used to talk about Northern California when I was a kid, it sounded like Big Rock, Candy Mountain. And probably from the time I was 11 or 12, all I dreamt about was packing my grip and hitchhiking to California, to Northern California specifically, because of the way that the regard she held it in. I just knew somewhere deep in my heart that I needed to go there above anything else.
Between busking on BART's Yellow Line and Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley, Charlie crashed with some distant cousins. But the street singing hustle had taken its toll by then, And not long after getting to the bay, Mendocino's greener pastures came calling.
I was a farmhand working for a couple different ranchers, a couple different ganja farmers, doing whatever, fence work, cleaning up after cows and horses, and picking grapes, any kind of side handiwork. It's funny because I'm a Texan, I'm from South Texas. My heritage, I got a lot of cowboy roots on my daddy's side.
I'm a $10 cowboy. Maybe that's a fact.
That's the side from which Davy Crockett hails. Yes, that Davy Crockett.
But I learned about horses and I learned about ranching and farming in Mendocino County.
And for a while, Charlie regularly made trips back and forth between the Redwoods and the city, moving significant quantities of cannabis well before legalization. All the while, he was immersing himself in the larger culture of Northern California.
Man, I mean, I used to hitchhike up and down the 101 with all kinds of Hare Krishnas and Rastafaris and, you know, all kinds of people on pilgrimages and trimmigrants and, you know, people from all over the world. And we would go down to San Francisco and go down on Polk Street, go down and see the free concerts in Golden Gate Park.
Charlie says his exposure to the radical politics and countercultural lifestyles of the Bay had an enduring impact on him.
I'd be glad to tell you the story. That kind of revolutionary ideas and people's movements. But it was my first time seeing anything like that. You know, I remember being in Golden Gate Park and people were thinking differently because of Wall Street crash and Occupy Wall Street and all the homelessness, you know, and the war veterans that were living on the street. And I had never seen anything like that, you know? And that's when the seeds were planted in my mind, like cultivating my ideas of being able to write my own songs.
Sure enough, tales of economic struggle and survival have proven to be a cornerstone of Charlie's catalog.
Anybody that I was related to besides my mama thought I had lost my damn mind. And maybe, as Waylon Jennings said,
I've always been crazy, but it's kept me from going insane.
And I've always been crazy, but California kept me from going insane, man. The Bay Area, and especially Mendocino County.
It was during this time in the Bay that he finally moved from being a street musician to hitting stages at bars and clubs.
The first time I ever got up on blues clubs and stuff was like the saloon there in North Beach, you know, getting up with the rockabilly and the older generation, all the black blues players, and then all the old black clubs in Oakland. They would ask you to play your music. If they saw a guitar on you, they wanted you to play. I've carried that with me everywhere I've gone.
Just as his performing career was finding some traction, though, the plant transport side of Charlie's life took a sudden left turn. He got snagged by cops in Virginia during one especially brazen contraband-carrying run. He did a month of jail time, managed to make bail, and promptly returned to Mendocino, rightly believing that the judge in his case would let him serve out his sentence on probation if he could show proof of a burgeoning music career. In short, after years of living as an outlaw, it was time to record his first album.
It was what I needed, man, to get my act together, and ended up cutting that record, Stolen Jewel, in the farmhouse for a ganja farmer I was working for in the winter after harvest.
While music streaming platforms had already taken off, in 2015, CDs were still a thing, and Charlie knew he needed to get his new album out in physical form as far and wide as possible. He drove his truck down to San Francisco to get a bunch of discs duplicated, or, as we used to say in those days, burned.
I sure did. Man, I can't remember the name of that place. I used to babble people crazy. Go down there and pay them cash. It was right down there off somewhere near downtown, maybe even near the Tenderloin, maybe? I can't remember where it was. And eventually I drove that truck down to Texas with all them CDs on me. I started, you know, handing them out on street corners in Dallas and Fort Worth and Austin.
So began Charlie's above-ground career. He started gigging in bars and clubs and quickly got written up in Texas newspapers. That got him noticed by an agent.
He worked me like a racehorse on the Hank Williams circuit for about 5 years before the big dogs came in.
As his notoriety's grown in recent years, so have the music industry's attempts to label him in sweeping or simplistic terms. But Charlie, of mixed racial heritage and multiple cultural confluences, tends to laugh off inane attempts at classification. He's as influenced by Bill Withers as he is Hank Williams Sr. He's almost always sporting a wide-brimmed cowboy hat, dapper 70s threads, and a stunning necklace with the falcon image of Isis, the ancient Egyptian goddess. To him, this aesthetic amalgamation is nothing if not natural.
America, have I told you how I labor in your fields?
As he gets ready to take the stage in front of 3,000 adoring fans, just days before the release of his 15th album, I ask Charlie to encapsulate the Bay Area's imprint on his artistry. Despite a fan base that runs the ideological gamut, does he feel a responsibility to espouse any of those revolutionary ideals he was first exposed to in Golden Gate Park?
This life that I live is a tightrope walk. It is walking the line. You know, when they'll say, Charlie, you're trying to have it both ways. I'll just say this. If I can't tell the truth as I see it in my songs, then I ain't worth very much.
And with that, the griot from San Benito's off to sing to his faithful, accompanied by a crew of ace musicians coloring his tales of life on the margins with some of the smoothest country blues this side of South Texas. In Oakland, I'm Raphael Cohen for Cross Currents.
If you remember me.
That was singer-songwriter Charlie Crockett speaking with Raphael Cohen. Be sure to catch Charlie and his band, the Blue Drifters, at Outside Lands in Golden Gate Park this Saturday. They play the Twin Peaks stage at 5:30.
It's easy to get lost in this life. America, can you see me?
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Our editor, Marissa Ortega Welch, has been a science reporter for KALW since 2017. She's also the host of Natural State, our bite-sized sound portraits from the landscapes and landforms of California. Today, we're excited to share a preview of a series she spent the last 3 years reporting. Here's a sneak peek.
You know, you think, oh, this is beautiful. And you go around the corner, it's like, oh, this is beautiful. And it just keeps going.
I'm hiking up a trail with a ranger in New Mexico's Gila National Forest to see a wooden sign.
I mean, the Gila's pretty wild.
This place is wild, officially. We're about to enter an area legally designated as wilderness. No roads, minimal structures, natural. A place where humans are just visitors. We get to a wide, shallow river, and the only way across is through.
You are not kidding about the river crossing.
Uh-oh.
Okay. Yeah, I should have put on my other shoes. Let's do it.
I'm Marissa Ortega Welch, and being in wilderness is my happy place. Seeing more mountains than people, away from roads and light pollution.
Here we are at the wilderness boundary.
Finally, we get to this big Flintstone-looking wooden sign. I've seen a lot of these signs, and they look the same, whether you're in California, Alaska, or Georgia. This one, though, is special.
The Gila Wilderness is the first designated wilderness in the world. And that whole concept was really born right here.
100 years later, the experience of wilderness is changing. From more fires, to more people on the trail, to more cell service. Today, wilderness isn't a place to unplug in a land untouched by humans. And of course, it never was. Wilderness areas were managed by indigenous people for millennia. For the last 3 years, I've talked to hikers, land managers, scientists, environmentalists, and indigenous leaders. following my fascination with wilderness around the West, trying to find out if our ideas about wilderness have changed. What does that mean for the physical places that we call wilderness? Do you have a paper map with you?
No, I don't have any paper maps at all.
What happens if your phone breaks?
My hiking partner also has a phone.
We did get caught in a lightning storm and we had a tree hit within about 60 yards of camp. Those guys never came back. I think we kind of gave them a little more wilderness experience than they could take.
There was a lot of trash and poop and toilet paper.
Glacier National Park is probably not going to have glaciers. We can't intervene on that one, right?
Wilderness doesn't mean anything to indigenous peoples. It's a category of land management that the United States maintains.
It's a complicated question. What is wilderness?
What is wilderness? The answer to that question says a lot more about us as humans than the land. Listen to the How Wild podcast from KALW Public Media, part of the NPR network. Join me in the wilderness this summer.
The first episode of How Wild comes out next Tuesday, August 13th. Make sure to take a listen. Find the link at kalw.org. Today's Cross Currents team includes Arun Nair, Afton Okwu, Julia Haney, Cherie Bishop, James Rowlands, Ganadijo Johnson, Victor Tentz, Shirin Adil, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trevney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.